Let's get started. Good afternoon again. Very, very excited to come back this afternoon and talk about...
You came back, amazing.
Because I didn't leave.
I know that some of you had questions before we closed the session.
I think this one was mine.
But what I want to do, because Ken might have to leave early, is let's get straight into the failures. We'll have everyone present, and then we'll have questions specifically for Ken. Right, first,
feels like special.
Everyone has been asked to do 10 minutes on failures. So if Ken would present, and then we'd have questions specifically for him, and then we'll spend the rest of the afternoon until 4, so we'll finish at 4 instead of 3:45, looking at working with the rest of the panel. Does that work for everyone?
Yes?
Yes?
Yes. Yeah.
Ah, excellent. Let's just get started and let's get into it. So Ken, 10 minutes talking about failures.
So I don't have any slides. Should I stand up or is it okay here? I'll stand up there. Okay. Sorry to be so difficult with this and have to leave early, but I have to do story time at home when I get back. real life kicks in at some point in this fairy tale story. So... some of this is really more of an extension in a way to what I started talking about this morning, which is how to get things right, but also how to not get things wrong, which is a failure piece for me. I've been really lucky. I get asked a lot when I speak at conferences to give an example of failure, and Frontline SMS was my first project, and it didn't fail. And I've been doing things since which have been a struggle for various reasons, and I can quickly share why that is. But on the whole, I haven't actually drastically failed at it very much at all. So I guess I've just been lucky. Or maybe I was just stubborn enough to stick something out long enough for it to become successful when it may have easily been a failure if I dropped it earlier. So maybe that's something that's worth thinking about. At what point do you decide something's not working and stop? And if you stuck it out a bit longer, could it turn into a success? Because most good commercial products don't start off by setting the world on fire. It takes a while, right? I mean, television didn't go down too well when the guy invented the TV, and many great inventions don't get traction straight away, but if you stick it out, then they can do. I think one, before I just whiz into these kind of bullet points of how to not fail, there was one project which I did try, and I think I know why I failed at that. I had this idea of, this was 6 months ago, of buying, and it's been a homeless theme actually in some of the chats I've had with people and over lunch. There's a town near where I live called Peterborough, and homelessness is a massive, massive problem. And I've always wondered about how people become homeless and what their life story is and whether they were at fault in any way, whether they just got unlucky, lost their job, then lost their marriage and then lost their home and ended up on the street. And they could be perfectly, you know, normal people like me, but just had really bad luck, whereas I've been lucky to not have that level of bad luck. So I wanted to buy a flat in Peterborough and then give it for free to a business person who had fallen out on their luck, who ended up on the streets, give them a year of free rent in a flat and then access to all the networks and people that I knew to try and help them get back on their feet. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have a flat, which became like an incubator thing? So I thought, I need £30,000 to put a deposit down on a buy-to-let, and there's lots of flats in Peterborough that are quite well priced. You can get a one or two bed flat for £100,000 in Peterborough. And so I did a Kickstarter campaign, and I explained what I was doing, but I didn't do a video, and I maybe didn't spend a massive amount of time on it. You had to give £250 to take a share in this flat, which is quite a lot of money for a lot of people. I don't know how many people here give that kind of money to a Kickstarter campaign. But I ended up, after about 2 months, of having one person supporting it. And one of the things I find quite interesting when I speak to people about my work, because I've been doing it for so long and I'm quite well known, there's almost an assumption that I can do anything I want. And I wish that was true, and maybe there'll be some other examples here. It would be great to be able to think that I could approach any of the donors I've ever spoken to and that every idea I had would be brilliant and every idea would resonate, but this one completely failed. I still totally love the idea, and I'm still going to totally try it, but I just think I need to be a little bit less lazy in how I sell it. You know, people aren't going to support it just because I think it's a great idea. They need to be convinced that it's a good thing. So maybe I need to do a bit more research. So that's an example of something that I very, very recently tried. And I'm about to launch a mobile app as well, so that might be a failure I can talk about next year. but hopefully not. So these things are actually in my second book. I had a chat with... Sorry, your name was...
Mauricio.
Mauricio, who's bought my second book and thinks it's brilliant. I did tweet about it this morning on the Kuanja handle. There's a 30% discount on it. So if you want to look at the Twitter, my Kuanja Twitter thing, if you want to get it in 3 days. But it's 13 case studies written by social innovators and entrepreneurs. They talk about their journey, their story, why they're doing what they're doing, what went wrong, what was hard. So although it's a pitch of a book, people that I know have read it have found it really, really interesting and inspiring. So if you want to look at that, by all means do. And these are in the book, so don't write them down if you want to buy the book. I think the first thing is about not being competitive. I say in the book there's plenty of poverty to go round. Sounds a bit corny, but there actually is. There's enough suffering and poverty to go around without having to compete for any of that. So if you compete, then I think that's a quick-fire way of failing and just not getting your message out there. Don't be in a hurry. A lot of projects fail, I think, because they rush too much. They want 3 months' results. You need to put in the long term. And this, again, has come out today, I think, quite a few times, that you have to give it everything. Literally, in some cases, everything. Don't assume you need money to grow. People always kind of wonder about that one. I see lots of people trying to find money really, really early. And the minute you have money, as we've again mentioned this morning, the clock starts ticking. There's a lot you can do with no money. I didn't have money for 2.5 years with my platform. And if I couldn't do a website, I learned to do a website. And if people say, well, you know, I don't have time to do a website, well, I would say that you're not committed to what you're doing then. If you're really, really committed to what you're doing, you will find a way to do the things that you need to do without money. I never took on volunteers because I just found it so much work getting people who really, really were committed. And I'm not belittling volunteering because it's really important, but to get a volunteer who sticks around for the duration and doesn't become a drain, I think it's hard. I found it really hard to find people, although they all started off with really great intentions. So I would say don't think about necessarily building a team of volunteers because that might be a shortcut to failure as well, unless you really get the right person. Be relentless. I spoke and wrote about my work at every opportunity and I bored the pants off people, but I never stopped. And I think that's why it got the traction it eventually got. Suppress your ego. I think ego is a great way of failing in a project. If it's all about you and not about the people who are trying to help, it's about staying humble, it's about staying curious, and about staying real. And again, from this morning's slides, just reminding yourself why you're doing what you're doing every day. And the minute you start to lose interest in that, maybe it's time to stop. Website's really important. It's, for most people, is the window onto your work. So if I see really bad websites for really good projects, it disappoints me so much because, you know, you're underselling yourself. Donors will go straight to a website. Media will go straight to a website. Maybe potential users will go straight to a website. It says a lot. It's about the fancy hair, gold-plated scarf, right? It's about what it says about you. It's your product, in a sense. Avoid the politics. That goes back to the earlier point as well, that I've seen people spend 60% of their energies just playing the politics in the field. And then you suddenly realize, hang on a minute, I'm only spending 40% of my time working on what I want to be working on. And the rest of the time, I'm just fighting fires from people I don't even like. So don't do it. Just don't rise to the bait. I think if you stay silent, you win the argument if people are being silly. Learning when to say no is also really important. I see a lot of projects who get distracted, sidelined. They pivot off in different directions because they see an opportunity which is not core to what they're trying to do because they're too afraid to say no to something which may end up, you know, being successful. Have a laser focus. And at the beginning, while you're trying to get established, it's hard to say no, but if you say no and you can stay focused on the main thing you're doing, I found that's absolutely absolutely key. And being open about the values that came up in the earlier point about just sharing everything about what drives you and what drives your organization and what drives your product and why you've built it the way you've built it. There aren't enough good stories like that out there. And the reason I did my books was because I didn't think there were enough good stories like that out there. There were lots of stories from people who had unpicked social innovation and social entrepreneurship and applied all sorts of theoretical lenses. But I find those stories really uninspiring. If you can tell your story well and tell it in a humane, humble way, you can achieve so much. And people will gravitate towards your work because you do that. Collaborate if it's in the best interests of solving your problem, even if it's not in your best interests. So That's an interesting one as well, because you may actually end up collaborating, and then that may actually be the end of your organisation if the other person has a better product. But if you're thinking about the big picture and thinking about the problem you're trying to solve, maybe the best thing you can do is actually to shut down what you're doing and go and work with someone else. So collaborating isn't always about getting together with somebody and then working together. Sometimes it can be getting together and then deciding that what you've got is actually inferior and being honest about that and just stopping doing it. Make full use of your networks and remember that the benefits of being in them may not always be immediate. I've often found that the best contacts I've had at conferences and events, they haven't really led to much for at least a couple of years. And then you start to think back as to where the connections came from, and you realise that it's someone you met then. It's rarely a follow-up straight after an event that actually leads to anything. Most conferences I go to are a complete waste of time. You meet lots of nice people, but you rarely get anything from them. And I can look back at PopTech in 2008 when I was a fellow there. There were two or three awards I won and contracts I got based on a talk. It was a five-minute talk that I gave at PopTech, which I can now trace back. But they didn't happen for three, in some cases, 4 years. So it's a real long-term investment in doing that. Remember the bigger picture. I think we've already talked about that. And that whatever you're trying to solve is bigger than any one person or organisation. Don't beat yourself up searching for your passion. I see this so much when I think you're a bit more advanced than that in this room at that stage. I speak to lots of really young people who are still trying to get on this path, and they are desperate to find a cause, a passion, something to latch them their time to. It's like going out on a Friday night to a nightclub and looking for a girlfriend or a boyfriend, I guess. You know, you're kind of, the more desperate you are, the least likely you are to find something. And you end up meeting the girl or boy of your dreams over the frozen food counter at Tesco. Kind of happens randomly. So for me, it's not about going and looking. It's about putting yourself in the environments in which these problems exist and let the problem find you. But you're not going to see that happen if you don't get yourself out there. Two more, write down your values and a quote that inspires you on a large sheet of paper and stick it on your wall. That again is that just reminding yourself constantly of what you're doing. And if you start to feel yourself losing resonance with that, then that's a signal that maybe you need to do something else or to move on. And when I ran a primate sanctuary in Nigeria for a year, going back quite a long time, I ended up fighting politics with another sanctuary in the same town. And it was a crazy situation that these two conservation organisations were fighting all the time. But I wrote down and stuck it on my wall because I found myself getting so distracted that I wanted to wake up every morning and the first thing I saw was that big reminder of why I was there and why I was suffering in this godforsaken country where nothing worked and it was really hot and I had malaria most of the time. And then the last one, I think it's about just striving to be a good person, which is, I think, underplayed sometimes. It's about helping everybody that you meet who's also trying to do good in the world. It's about sharing what you have. It's about sharing contacts. It's about giving time to people. I give as much time as I could possibly give to anyone who wants to talk about their work or my work. I volunteer on lots of things. Because at the end of the day, there's a great chance that those people will end up doing far greater things than I ever do. And I've been invited to weddings. I got invited to a wedding in India recently because I helped somebody get an internship about 8 years ago at Stanford. And that's really nice, isn't it? That, you know, it's that kind of ripple, butterfly, beautiful kind of hippie thing, right? You get the wings flap and it all. But it's true. You know, if you don't agree with somebody or you don't even necessarily agree with their approach, stay positive and encourage them, but give them good, solid advice and just be nice about it. Because there's enough horrible stuff in the world without us joining in, and we're meant to believe in what we're doing. So all of those are in the book, and kind of all the other authors give their tips a little bit like that. So if that makes any sense or you're interested, then by all means, get that. And that chapter is actually free on my website. So if you don't want to buy the book but you want to get those, it's on the Qandra website. Okay, thanks.
I think to give Ken the most flexibility, what about it? Do you all have any specific questions for Ken? Even this morning, I know I stopped some of you guys sort of mid-track. Or if you want to talk about any of the failures before we move on to the other players. Because I just want him to be comfortable that he needs to run out. Yeah.
I just want to ask Ken, because you mentioned that it took like 2 years for frontline SMS actually being used by someone and making it become significant. So during those 2 years, didn't you feel that you were failing?
No, because I didn't know what failure was going to look like. It wasn't costing me any money, and I was enjoying it, and I had a very small group of users who I really liked. When I got the email in the first 2 weeks from Zimbabwe and they told me what they were using it for. I mean, you just think, wow, this is important. And so you almost start to feel people depending on you, that if you stop, that you're going to let these people down. For me, it's very personal. This work has always been really personal. And there's always this kind of debate about if it should be professional, you should always be professional, all that kind of stuff. I'm completely not that. I mean, the work I do means everything to me, and there's nothing else I would do. And so I just had users that I loved and respected, and I became friends with them. So I didn't. If I'd only ever had 20 users, I would have been happy, because I never had this vision of producing a big globally scaled product. It was never in my mindset. And so I just kept it going in the evenings, and I loved responding to the emails, and I used to talk about it at conferences, and I'd always email journalists and other people working in the sector who I thought might be interested in what I was doing. But those first 2 years were really, really quite easy. It got harder when the money came, because then expectations went up and you had to start delivering. And when you end up with a product that's being used so widely, you do feel a certain degree of responsibility for it. Yeah. When you have, you know, there's a, you know, in Afghanistan, I got an amazing email from CARE, who had sent a blast out to staff one day when there had been a Taliban attack at a road thing that they used. And the email just said, there was a big attack today. We alerted our staff with frontline SMS, and we got them all back safely. And so you think to yourself, what's more important than that? Like, what could I have done today that is going to beat that? And what could I do tomorrow that could ever beat that? And there's nothing. So there was never a point. I did think maybe, approaching 2 years in of stopping it, but it wasn't a drain on me. And I'm glad I did stick it out.
Yeah. So it feels to me that it's usually about the goals that you set up to yourself.
Mm.
Your sense of failure also depends on the goals that you put yourself.
And also, nobody was still at that point even building tools like it. There were all these grassroots users who didn't have the technical knowledge or the money or the skills to do what this platform did for them, and that wasn't going to change. If somebody else had built something 10 times better in that time and everyone started using that instead, I would have probably said, yeah, fine, that's a better product. Mm-hmm. They've got more resources. I'll stop. But, you know, even to this day, nobody's built anything that does what it does. Which is, I think, crazy in a way, because at least learn from the approach. So, it was a great question. And failure was never in my mind. You have to have an end goal that you set yourself in order to know that you failed, and I didn't have an end goal. Which maybe is a bad thing to say.
See, you don't have an end goal.
Ken, if you don't mind me saying it, it seems like you're like a serial change maker. My question is, what's next? You've been doing a lot of things, you've been utilizing your platforms and resources for many, many different types of issues. What motivates you now? What kind of issue do you see in front of you that should be tackled in the right way? It seems to me that the way you do it for you is the right way. We all agree that seems to be as well.
Yeah.
So what's next?
I guess, there are three things to avoid spending too much time on it. One is a third book.
Okay.
So I've got about 11 African technologists at different levels, from programmers up to policymakers, who are writing about their vision for technology on their continent, because no one seems to have written that. Mm. I'm not writing it, I'm editing it. So I'm looking forward to that, because that for me is like, what do Africans want to see the future look like? I'm sick and tired of hearing people like me talk about it. I want to know what they want. So I think that's going to be an interesting book. So that will hopefully be out next year if I can get the money to publish it. But they're writing the chapters now. I haven't told them I haven't got money to publish it, but I will find it from somewhere. It'll be good enough to publish. So there's that. And then I think just touching on all of the systemic dysfunction that I talked about this morning, this hackingdevelopment.org website, which summarizes the four areas that I feel I can contribute to. So I'm focused on that. And in fact, the book is an element of that hacking development initiative. I don't think I'm ever going to change anything. But I do meet people who've done their work differently because they've seen the things I've written about and seen the stories from the books that I've edited. And that's maybe the expectation I should set myself, that I will not get DFID or USAID or any government to do anything differently, because, let's face it, they just don't, right? They just go about doing their own thing. But I will continue to shout about what I think is wrong and call out people and call out donors when I think they're funding really bad projects. When I talk at conferences and I criticise donors, I can feel the air leaving the room. Like, people are too afraid to criticise donors, because without donors, you know, who are we? But I'm not funded by anyone. I can be honest, and I think they're valid arguments that most of the rubbish projects out there have been funded by somebody. They are just as responsible for that bad project existing than the person who did it. So that's part of this hacking development thing as well. So that's the second one. And then the third one, I'm working on this mobile app, which will hopefully be out early next year, which allows you to purchase tangible items that grassroots NGOs need in their work. So you could buy a school desk for an NGO in Kenya that's working with schools. You could buy a water treatment kit for a hospital in Uganda that's trying to get pure water to communities there. And so you build up a portfolio of physical things that you can buy to support them. And it's all grassroots stuff, so it's a bit like a kind of a direct giving type thing. And it's nearly there. I raised some money for it. It's been a tough journey because the money was never enough to build an app and a back end. But we're really close to launching that in beta. So that's the other thing that's keeping me going. And I work with the Disaster Emergencies Committee a little bit on a contract. But I'm actually out of work in January. I have no paid work in January. But that's fine. I've always believed that something will come up.
So. We'll talk in January.
Please do.
Okay, two quick questions. One, two. And then I have my question about AI, so let me pre-warn you, and then we will switch. You guys are fine with going a little later, right?
Yeah.
Our next session is at 5.
But don't let me throw any of the timing. I'm not that important.
No, it's fine. Like, let me just do this. That's fine. Last two.
You're in charge.
Say that again.
You're in charge.
Yeah. Okay. So two quick questions, and then I'll ask about AI, and then we'll move on. But I know the rest of the panel can stay later than 3:45.
Okay.
Because I have them for another 5 p.m. session.
So. Oh, that's fine. Yeah. Sorry, I'm missing that.
Yeah.
How have you managed? You mentioned that you were living for 12 years in Africa.
Well, on and off. Yeah, I wasn't there for the whole 12 years.
But you were developing and trying to understand the root cause problem and everything. How have you managed to cover your living expenses during that amount of time? How have you managed to cover your living expenses during all of the
projects
that you have
learned? Yeah. How
do you
live?
How are you living?
The easy answer is actually the correct answer. I had no living expenses. I had no mortgage. I had no children. I wasn't engaged or married. I didn't have any loans. So I just upped and went. And just went anywhere that I felt was a good place to go. And so a good example, on the day of 9/11, I was actually at the university in Sussex, and I found a primate sanctuary that was looking for someone to run the primate sanctuary in Nigeria. And I applied the next day, and I was off in a month. So I just kept very lightweight and nimble. I thought, I want to be able to take advantage of any opportunity that I see to go out and learn, and that means not having a girlfriend, not having any loans, not having a car, not having a flat, sleeping on people's sofas and just bumming it, basically. And so that's how I did it. And I didn't earn a lot of money over that time, but I calculated once I probably lost £100,000 or £200,000 in earnings by not working. So that's my personal payment, I guess, into the system for me. But I just kept it really, really low cost. When I was at Stanford for 2 years, I was self-funded, so I bought a camper van and I lived in the car park for 2 years. And so I was the only MacArthur grantee ever to get money from MacArthur's for living in a van. So I sold the van, and I sold it for $500 less than I bought it. It cost me $500 to live in Silicon Valley for 2 years. Wow. So it's just about, how committed are you? And I also just always wanted to live in a van.
It takes education.
In California as well, in California.
What's up, Guy?
So this question is for another student who's not here right now, so we're going to bless him out.
What? I didn't get permission for that. Just kidding.
even though you're in charge. right now she's dealing with an interesting situation. She's very passionate about sustainable sort of evaluation, impact evaluation. And someone in the UK has built a great algorithm to evaluate multiple charities. Operations and a really, really outside the box thinking. And she approached that person thinking, we could do this in India. And the person said, great, I know, why don't you work for me for a little bit? And eventually, long story short, the person's, whatever she would contribute would remain in that organization, and it'd be impossible for her to bring it back outside. So there's a clear barrier for cooperation.
Yeah.
And so she has therefore two options. One, convince this individual to let her sort of build this, like you said, there's enough room for everyone, especially in India. Or develop her own, so in the sphere of failure, those two seem to be sort of unequal in terms of difficulty.
Yeah.
And in your experience in the field, is there a specific way in which you've found that you could convince people to share their specific intellectual knowledge.
If someone, if I ever met someone who had built something who was deliberately holding it back from doing good in other places, I would question them.
Yeah, but sadly they are annoying, but their app is good.
Well, yeah, I mean, if they're... So there's got to be some motivation for them not wanting to take this to markets where it can be useful. Whatever that motivation is, I don't know. If I saw something which clearly had potential in other areas that the person who had it refused to take it into, I would do something myself. And I'd replicate it. I think that's a valid reason for replication. Just like, you know, like, screw you, I'm going to go and do my own thing. Because, you know, if there's, I don't know what the app does, but if it's potentially going to put things right in other places, then you're kind of almost, suffering continues because you're refusing for some stubborn, egotistical reason to not do it. It's like having a, it's like the drugs thing, really, in a way, isn't it? You think there's drugs that can cure most conditions on the planet, yet a lot of people don't have access to drugs that they need because they've been priced out of the market, and the people that own the rights are less interested in helping people really, and they're more interested in making money, and it's kind of, there's that moral ethic. So I think if I was that person, I would just go off and build a better app and crush them.
I question about AI. Everybody's talking. I actually got AI. Asked this question, so I'm cheating. Yeah. At the last conference, how will AI disrupt social innovation in places like Africa, in the most remote places? There are loads of people who have differing opinions. Have you thought through? Do you think it will have an impact at all in the next 3 to 5 years? I
try to deliberately not think about stuff like that. I would say no. Personally, I don't think it's going to be significant. I think there's a lot of new technologies that we're still trying to figure out how to make them work. I think people are still trying to figure out the drone thing, open data thing, figure out 3D printing, these kind of new technologies. But half the world still doesn't have access to the internet, and half the world, even more of the world, doesn't have a smartphone or any kind of device that would even have any kind of connection with anything really AI-based. I think we're probably going to destroy ourselves before we are able to destroy other people with it. It's kind of, but no, I don't have an opinion.
Awesome.
Apart from that opinion. Maybe I don't have an opinion.
You have a thinly veiled opinion.
Thinly veiled, like most of my opinions.
Yes. Yeah. The best opinions. Yeah.
Okay.
I think there's enough problems we can solve today that are causing suffering without other people can worry about what happens in 5 years for me. If you can help someone today with something, then you should just get on with that bit.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much. Okay, so we'll go in reverse order. Just so I like to mix things up.
So Ariana. I'm up. Okay.
Yes.
I did prepare a presentation. Well, it's actually just a continuation on the previous one. Failures. Right. So, well, I know that there's lots of Colombian people here, and Colombians have this way of knowing each other. So you might know who the person that I'm going to talk about is. I apologize in advance for that. Right, so my failures. Well, Basilis is doing great, and we are having a wonderful time, and me and my business partner could not be happier with our company, except for a few flaws. We did have a previous company that was born out of Generate. Basilisa wasn't the name of the project, and it wasn't the original idea. The original idea that we pitched to Generate was called Evie and Moo, and it worked with indigenous communities in La Guajira Peninsula, and we made upscale versions of the very common beach bag. We also were thinking of developing within the brand of Evie and Moo, a jewelry line and a fan line. We had all these sort of amazing dreams of creating what is called affordable luxury. So what's in the price point of $100 to $350. It blew up in our faces. It was catastrophic. And it wasn't catastrophic because the company didn't make any money, because we were literally 2 sales away from breaking even. It blew up catastrophically because we didn't get along. We all had very different visions for the company, and we couldn't come to an understanding about what we wanted to do, that we actually had to involve lawyers to dissolve a company that was worth $5,000. It was ridiculous, and it cost me sweat, tears, blood, two boyfriends. It was literally, it broke up to, it was horrible. And I will give you now what happened. I will walk you through it, and I will give you like how I know I could have done it better now. So the first thing is be passionate and proud about what you're doing. While I love the idea of working with indigenous communities, which I still do now, and I think that it's wonderful, I didn't like our product. I wear these beach bags literally to the beach, unlike most Colombian people who wear them everywhere. And when my friends asked me what I was doing, I would be like, oh, we're doing this wonderful product. And they're like, why don't you wear it? And I was like, it doesn't go with my fashion style. Why would I? So that was weird when I told people what I was doing. And it made it really awkward. And I wasn't really proud because I wasn't selling it. And I wasn't, you know, now with Basilisa, I tell everyone, like literally anyone who will listen, I'm like, no, it's amazing. But I wasn't with Evie and Moo, which obviously showed, and it showed in the dedication that I put towards it. This is the most important one. Make time for paperwork. You will agree to things often and time again, and you will say, we will deal with a shareholders agreement later. We will draft those documents later. We will create that later. Later never comes, and then you don't have things in writing, and people will go like, oh, I never agreed to that. Oh, no, I never said that was my percentage. Unless it's in writing, and I've come to learn this really difficult, if you have a conversation on the phone, send out an email that summarizes a conversation and make sure they answer back acknowledging that they received it and they agreed with it, because that is legally binding. And you can take that to an attorney. Lend when it's best to cost your losses. So I had three different instances in which I could have said, I am going to get out of this company and venture on my own, or I'm going to, you know, we're going to get rid of this one partner that was the one that we disagreed with. And I saw the first alarm and I was like, no, it's probably me. I know I'm a difficult person. I can be more understanding. You know, you sort of like talk yourself into saying you can do better. Then I had a second alarm, basically about the same thing, until the third time came and it was a problem of like just literally negotiating stake that she was attributing herself, more stake that she had already agreed to. So that caused our legal problems and sort of like the whole, it was a 4-month process, which was ridiculous. I've seen bigger companies and like bought mergers and acquisition companies go by faster than what took us, than how long it took us. So if I had said, no, I cannot continue working with you on the first instance or the second one, I would have saved myself 6 months of work that I could have devoted towards Basilisa. Just when necessary. This is what I was saying about kill your babies. If your product isn't working, you need to fix it. If no one is buying it and no one shows interest in it, it's because it's not working. It doesn't matter if you love it. And we had this like amazing line and we thought we were going to revolutionize the market, and we did not make one sale. All of our other products were selling amazingly, but like that one that we thought this is our thing, not one sale. Change the people. If your designer isn't working, change it. If your code, if your programmer isn't working, change it. If it isn't working, don't try to fix it. If like at first it doesn't work, there's no reason it's going to work in the long run. And just sort of like know that you need to adjust. Don't force it, bend to it. Learn what to compromise and what not to. I learned that I can compromise on how much I work as opposed to my business partner. My business partner has a full-time job, and she says I can only work from this hours to this hours. So I know that my Tuesday evenings every 2 weeks are devoted to Basilisa, and I have no life from like that Tuesday to that following Thursday because we need to work until 11 p.m. But I have no problem with that. I can't compromise giving away creative control of my company. So Emily had to accept the fact that we weren't going to receive outside investment. When you have that level and you speak it and put it out in the open, I think it's easier because you know what you're getting yourself into. And it is very important to be very honest with the people that you're working with with regards to what can be done and what cannot be done. So six is make sure that there is dialogue. Conversations, if you have a problem, talk it up, you know, just talk it over. I once had a boss who, she was going through a divorce, and she was saying, it is more difficult to get a business partner that you get along with than you can get a relationship that you get along with. And she's like, and I've been married twice. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that says a lot, because it means how many people that you've actually talked to in creating a business don't, you know, those things just don't pan out because you don't get along. And if you don't have this ambition for a company, it's not going anywhere. You're going to be like the kid that keeps getting pulled apart by the two different NGOs trying to vaccinate him. And it is your baby. A company is very much like a child. And then seven is create a support system outside of your company and inside of it as well. Because while I can talk to my business partner about all the issues and all the problems, and I am the more sort of like creative type of the both of us, so I often call her and I'm, you know, in a stupor crying and saying, these people are ruining our product, this is awful. She knows that she has to calm me down, and it works both ways. But I also need people around me that understand how difficult it is to create a company, that it's late nights, that it's really hard, that you have to devote your money, your time, and you work 80-hour weeks instead of 40-hour weeks for a quarter of the pay. But it is sort of like important to keep that in mind. And I think that those are my sort of, my biggest failures have all come down to not choosing the right people to work with and not communicating enough. Which now I have learned, and now I'm very happy where I am. So if I can manage it, you can all manage it. So that's it. Awesome. Oh, wait, no, there was the last one that I forgot because I added it in this morning. Fail cheap. You will fail. Just try to fail for as little money as possible, because then you can carry on doing what you're doing. It was like, if the product doesn't work, it's £1,000 out the window, doesn't matter, the next one will. And now I'm done.
You just want us to clap twice.
Yes!
Oh, hang on, there's one more.
I did say I was a creative type, so.
Okay, cool. Evelyn, do you want to go?
Yeah, that's great.
Awesome. And then we'll just open the floor up to us all three questions, or four of you questions.
Great. So I actually had a presentation prepared as well, but before that I want to say something else, because I thought of that today. One second. Yeah, so before starting my presentation, what I actually wanted to start with, it's not doing what I want, is to listen to other people. And why did I realize, or why did I had to think of that again today, is the fact that whenever you start doing a social entrepreneurship, you don't know what's coming, basically. So you can prepare as much as you want your business plan, and you can anticipate certain issues that might emerge. But by listening to other social entrepreneurs, like you're able to do today, and other two events that are coming up as part of these series, you actually get a lot of support in terms of your model, but more so emotional support, I would say. So that's really the most important thing I think I can stress. So attend these events, meet other social entrepreneurs, and try to get to know as much as possible, because that's what's going to make the difference. So it allows you to first and really anticipate the problems on the model side, as I mentioned. But more so, it really helps that I can relate myself to the other social entrepreneurs, that I know that I'm not the only person in a position, that I'm not the only person that has experienced difficulties transforming their idea into reality. So that's something that before I address the other issues, that I really want to communicate to you all. So really good that you're here today. So more specifically to the program is the failures that I or lessons learned that I encountered in working in Salto. So those are financial self-sustainability, human capital retention, and coordinated upscaling. It sounds a bit academic, but I'm going to try to focus on the solutions. So first, diversify your funding sources. So that's really, really important that you not only your funding sources for the organization, but also for yourself. So I spoke to a lot of social entrepreneurs in Peru. We're part of a network there, and everyone is working part-time or is working and working on the project at the same time, or they have a lot of different ways to deal with that. So what I'm trying to say with this is your project is your priority, but at the same time, you need to be realistic and given the time until you can make a living out of it effectively. So that's really important to realize that. And for the project itself, I already explained that in the first part of the seminar. Then I would encourage a flexible human resource system. So we spoke a bit about volunteers today, which is, it's always difficult to continue to motivate people. And that's why for Salto, what has really helped us is to create a human resources where you're cooperating based on motivation, but also a lot of intangible benefits. I'm currently reading a lot about human behavior and human motivation, and that's helping me a lot. So that's also maybe a lesson to don't only learn about your product and your market, but also learn about how people think and in different environments, but also in general, how do people think and how can I respond to that? So that's more the managerial part, maybe. And a third solution would be, in general, the ecosystem for social enterprise. I think there's a lot of interesting opportunities there. I'll mention it later. So when you graduate, you might want to start a social enterprise. But at, on the flip side, there's also a lot of opportunities in the social enterprise movement that are really interesting to investigate and to help on. So you can approach social entrepreneurship from different sides. The human capital retention I already mentioned. Try to learn people, understand people. We're currently working with a volunteer model, which is part-time and on a basis of are you available, are you motivated for the specific project, and that's something that works for us, but for every organization it will depend and it will be different. And the last part would be realism and internal checks and balances. So that's something I already mentioned in the Golden Nuggets, that it's really easy to want to expand your idea and implement it as fast as possible, but you need to have the correct internal checks and balances installed to assure that the relationship between the quantity of people reached and the quality per project stays in touch effectively. So that's my last lesson learned, I would say. This is just a summary of how you can contribute. That's all I wanted to say.
And last but certainly not least, we end where we began.
We have a presentation.
You're right there.
Yeah. No, it's all right. I was trapped. But
we all bashing into
yes,
the chairs.
Yes, yes. It's cooperation.
That's it. A dance of the chairs.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Like musical chairs.
Okay, so we wanted to make it a little bit fun because this is so sad to talk about. No one likes to talk about their parody, so you're sorry. So the first, we're going to tell you about our failures so you can see that they're real. The first one is don't ever plan an event without proper research. This it's you can put it in product, you can put it in investigation, a service. I mean, we thought that we had this huge, amazing event in Santiago, and we said, hey, let's do it in another city. And I just picked a city just because I knew people there. And so I said, this works perfectly in Santiago. I know the right people in this other city. Let's do it there. We spent $1,000 to the trash because no one was interested, no one understood, no one liked it. There was no money, there was no sponsors, there were no brands. So well, then Nicole and Daniela, which are the other two directors, they were just telling me to stop it. Stop trying to do something over there. And I'm like, no, I can do it. I can do it. No, stop wasting money, please. Like, 6 months wasting money, traveling by airplane every month. And then at some point, they told me, they pulled the trigger. Stop it. I mean, you're going to ruin it. And I did. And it was horrible. And we promised never try to do something new in a new place without the proper research. You have to know which are your customers, which are the people who have money there, where are you staying, what are the costs, what is the value, is it worth it, is it not, it's an investment. So you sometimes are doing something so good, and it's the same thing that happened to you. It's like, you sell scarves so well, can we sell hats? Yes, no, not necessarily. So yeah, do the proper investigation.
Yeah. Yeah, this is another one that happened this year, actually, a few months ago. Don't compete with yourself. Sometimes we want to do it all, but we can. So in this case, we were having like free events, free campaigns at the same time, and we have to communicate them. And we are over and over and over, and media was like, what do you want me to write about, you know? And so people was like, where are we going? So you were delivering these different messages, but you are not getting to the point. So think about what you have to do, prioritize, you know. For us, it was so tiring. Like Amila said before, we got not sleep at all. It's going horrible. And yes, you can do things right, but plan good, you know, prioritize, and don't compete with yourself. You need to rest also.
So, this is horrible. I mean, I went to a vegetarian festival last year, and this was very similar of what we do, but it was much more of talks and lectures. So I went there. It was a venue in a hotel. So they gave me this magazine. And it had the program of the venue, and they sell that magazine to me for like $1 or $2 maybe. And I thought, of course I'm going to buy the magazine because it has the program of the event. I mean, it's obvious. So I thought, well, I could create a magazine, sell ads to the magazine, put the program there, and sell it in the event. So no, no one bought the magazine because our event, it's free. It's open. I mean, you get 50 people getting in to a huge entrance. It's not the same that getting in through one door. When people stop, it's not that many, it's not crowded. You get time to see what's the magazine about. So we had millions, I mean 5,000 magazine put in the stands on the front entrance, and no one bought the magazine. It was horrible. We printed so much paper. It was horrible in like 10 different ways. I mean, we lost money. It got printed. We printed so many issues. We had to recycle everything. We had so much garbage at the end. No one knew the program because it just was there and no one bought it. So no one knew what was going on through the day. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I thought, oh, this is a great idea that they're doing, but I didn't see the context on that was working. Why was that working in that context, and what would it work in mine? So I jumped into a conclusion that didn't work, and we lost a lot of money and time, and oh my God, horrible.
So this is like for you to organize. Don't ever miss a deadline. We work with a lot of clients. We work with a lot of companies, brands that don't test on animals, and we create alliance with them. And sometimes we do so much that we are not respecting the schedules. So that can happen. I mean, the client gets mad. You are like, well, running around.
I know, in circles.
Because you have to respect a deal, always, you know. Sometimes, because you have a good relationship with someone, it doesn't necessarily mean they are going to put up with you with everything, you know. And not because you are a social innovation or an NGO, they're going to say, okay, it's okay, you're an NGO, I get it. No, they don't get it. So you have to be professional and responsible and always on schedule.
Yeah, and I'll add up. What you add up, I mean, always put everything in writing, especially if you're working with clients and you have alliances, everything on writing, because the paper said it's due the 15th, but if it's not in paper, he can say it's due the 5th. you don't know, so it's very important. Yeah. This is everything is horrible. I hate it. So don't give to any option. This is because we can do so many things, and I am the creative part also. So I always invent something to sell. I love selling things. So sometimes during this year, it happened that our clients got confused. Like, okay, but what do you do? And I say, I can do anything. Because I can sell you something in social media, I can go to your store, I can do an event, you can be a sponsor. So I had so many choices that the client could put their money in that they didn't put their money in because they got confused. Because we stopped getting focused and stopped coming up with new things in the meeting. So I was at the meeting and I came up with the idea and I'm like, no, I have a new thing to sell you. And he was like, okay, so what are you selling? And I'm like, selling so many things that we realize that if we can focus on one or two and just give a couple of options, and then from that idea start working together with the client to come up with a new one, it's different if you have 30 options in an email that no one is going to read. So yeah.
Don't burn a good product. This is connected with what Camila said recently, because sometimes you have something that works, so you try to sell that to everyone. Okay, this is working for this client. I'm going to try to sell this to everyone. That's not always right. Sometimes a client for us needs something else, you know, not this exact product. So you have to know your client story before research, as we already said. So keep that in mind.
Don't save money on your accountant. Please, if you want to save money, don't do it on the guy that's managing your taxes. Don't. You're going to get in trouble, and get in trouble with taxes, you can go to jail. So at first we worked with a really cheap accountant, and she was so nice. She was really nice. She was a nice person, but she was horrible.
She's not a very good accountant.
So yeah, basically she barely responded to our email. She did the basic stuff, and then we got a huge problem with, it's called Servicio Impuesto Internos in Chile. So we're still paying money because of all of these things that this girl did that didn't do. So if you want to save money on something, do your own website. Don't do your own account if you don't know or you don't have the skills to do it. Please, you're going to get in trouble like 7 years from now. You're going to say like...
Don't give it up. Don't get beat up by haters. So as in the morning we told you, we are now launching a campaign about cruelty-free cosmetics with another organization called Human Society International. And their model is bring famous people to the campaign so they can support the bill and generate more movement on the population. And this brought us so many problems, so many haters on social media, because not everyone there is vegan, and we know that, but because we want to address all population, not just vegetarians or vegans. We want to raise awareness in all Chilean people. So it was really exhausting because we have never had this kind of hate through us. Every day when people saying, why, you are not being responsible, you are not being coherente, coherent, right? So don't give it up. You know you're doing something good, so keep up, but this is going to happen.
And Nicole answered all of the messages for girl. Like weeks and weeks receiving hate, it was horrible.
Yeah, with respect and love, respect, always.
okay, so don't put yourself in uncomfortable situations. We have so much in common. I mean, the same thing happened to us. It's winter. We both hate winter. So we decided to do an event on winter. So we are
in the south of Chile.
In the south of Chile.
Why?
So now we are dragging our bags, trying to install everything. It's freezing, it's raining, we're wet, we're cold, we're tired, we're angry, and we ask ourselves, why did we do this to ourselves? Why are we doing this in winter? We don't want to do this in winter. And we couldn't believe that our past selves decided to do an event in winter in the south of Chile. I mean, it was ridiculous. So now we're We just stayed at the office in winter.
We can go in summer to the south of Chile. And it's
we can do anything in summer, but in winter we're staying in our office. We're not going to suffer. This is the picture of that place. Look at Nicole's hands in the bottom. It has this glove. Like we're freezing. This, that's the only part of her finger that's showing because we were covered all over and suffering and angry and frustrated just because it's so cold and we hate it.
And now
everything's fine. the resume for this is that you have to learn from your mistakes and take it as a, of course, learning opportunity. But it's going to happen over and over. And now, like last week, we got an email from a new accountant, like, this thing happened from 2016. It's like, oh my God, it's not over. So you think it's over, the problems are over or not? They keep coming, so you have to just learn how to deal with them in a positive attitude so you don't drown into the negative part of the business.
That's thank it. You.
So I'll open it up for questions for the whole panel now. Anybody? Yes?
I have one question for you. That is, how do you manage your marketing towards the price? Are you using the competitors as a reference, or are you using... Because I know, like, in South America, there's not that much knowledge about this kind of product and being vegan with cosmetics and all. How do you establish your price?
You want the proper response or you want the real one? I invent price. Yeah. I charge as much as I can. If it sells, it sells. Yeah. And if it's not, I lower it until I can sell it. So because it's new, that what we do doesn't exist anywhere in the world, so I have no references. No one's selling what we sell. Because, for example, in the events, the biggest sales that I get, there are no events like ours in Latin America. Yeah. So I just pull up the numbers as high as I can, and I see, I'm like always like, and then I'm like, oh, there's such a special offer that I can drop down 20%, and if it sells. So it's funny because I have 4 sponsors, each one of them is paying a different amount of money because it's as much I could sell them. And then I learned that year, I mean, I could sell, for example, 1,500, 100. And then I took that as a base for next year, and then I go prices up, and I know that's the year before is as low as I can get. Okay. And then I pull up the prices the next year, and I do the same. So it's like try all the time.
And a question for you.
Yes. for you.
No, it's okay, you're in charge.
Did you manage to enter the market? Knock on doors, call, you will, I mean, out of 100 calls, 95 will hang up on you, and 5 will be like, oh, interesting, tell me more. Just do that. And then, I mean, I harassed all of my father's friends and all of my mother's friends and every single person that I met on the street that for some reason I was like, you look like you could afford this. And those people know other people, and eventually you build up your private client base, and in luxury, private clients, when you're a small company, really make the core of your sales.
Can you tell them the story about France?
Oh, yeah. So I went to France on a completely unrelated project.
Just tell you how relentless she is. So better not see you on a beach. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
I went to France on a completely unrelated project for something to do with film, actually, nothing of the sort. And it was last month, and I was sitting across a table from this couple from the US who were just lovely. Like halfway through the conversation, I was literally wondering if they could adopt me because like they were just so nice. It just went on, and I was talking, and then they asked, like, oh, what do you do? And I told them, and I was like, yes, really happy, and it's, like, very nice because it's Baikuna. And the woman, like, the wife, said, like, oh, of course, I've always wanted something from Baikuna, but, like, I don't really like the things from Loro Piana. And as soon as she said that, I was like, well, let me tell you about my company. And I explained everything and went through it all, and then she goes, oh, you should really, really meet my niece, because she is the buyer of our store. And I'm like, what's your store? It turns out that it's the biggest store in Vail, Colorado, which is a spa, like ski sort of like resorty town that where all the people, it's very glitzy and glamorous. And they have the biggest store, the cheapest thing there is Gucci. And as soon as I said that she was, I was like, no, we're like, we're more fashionable alternative to Laura Piana. She was like, we would love to have that in a store. As soon as you have a sample, send it over and I'll let you know how many I want. And I was like, can I have that in writing? And she was like, of course, this is a soft offer. And I was like, amazing. So you never know. I was not expecting, like, I was at a film writer's thingy. It had nothing to do with fashion, and yet you find that people have really weird connections. And one of my really, really actually, this is another one that I never told you, but now I am. When we were dissolving EVMU, we need to hire a lawyer, but of course the company was worth $5,000. I wasn't going to pay, and you know, a proper law firm to do it. I literally called my friend and said, can I get you a brownie? And will you look at this contract? And she said, of course. We later were talking and talking over, and then when we were building the Basilisa contract, we said we need a sway. We can't have it 50-50. So we decided to give 2% to this lawyer who had helped us through all this process. And she goes like, oh, that's amazing, because I was going to tell you that my aunt is really good friends with Lauren Santo Domingo, who is the person who runs Moda Operandi, who is this huge platform. She was like, as soon as we have a project, I can just call her and we can get it in Moda Operandi. And I was like, amazing, yes, let's do that. It's a wonderful thing. We gave you 2% of this company. So it really is kind of like that. You would be surprised how many people know people that will be useful.
And this is really important. What I want to distinguish here by having such a range of people is that there are different competencies. I hope you're picking up for the different types of business, right? So the competencies for that business, if you want to kind of upscale your fashion and move into that market, is a completely different competency for building a consultancy, you know, in poverty pretty much, or with micro enterprises, and a completely different capability. This is really strong marketing communication. You see it from their slides, from the way they do everything. Skills based. Look at her presentation, extremely about the different skills, the structure of it, the way it's thought out. So what you have to start asking yourself as social entrepreneurs is, where do my competencies lie if I am passionate about this type of business? And if I don't have the competencies to upskill, where do I find Eliane? Can I afford to have her represent me? Because it is a different kind. A lot of people think they can break into those markets, but you need a particular skill set to break into all these markets. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I could never do this because marketing is definitely not my strong point, right? And the idea of me thinking, oh, this is amazing, and going and building that company is farcical given my skill set, right? So it's just understanding that there's four different types of skill sets in front of you to build successful but very different companies. Any more questions?
I had a question.
Sorry, it's just there was a weird thing. Don't worry, you're gonna be next.
Okay.
The sign is late.
Were the latest products created in Chile, because they're so unique in South America, where do you create them and where do you get the materials to do them?
We didn't communicate right, because we don't. Okay. This is our problem. We don't do cosmetics. We don't sell cosmetics. We have nothing to do with the product. What we do is we certify that someone else's product is not being tested on animals, and we communicate to people that they should buy that type of product. We inform consumers, and so what we do, our service is publicity, but we give publicity to other companies that are in our database because they are certified by us or by other companies.
Mm-hmm. Our product is raising awareness, actually. Yeah. So.
Okay, so I have a question for you too. I wanted to know, how do you create a positive awareness? Because you said that people don't want to hear about problems, and I think it's something that is problematic in a lot of social problems.
Yeah.
So how do you do that in a positive way?
Because we thought about it so much. We are addressing a different
necessary. Oh, well, sorry. I was going to say that in Spanish. You know, so people use these products every day. I mean, you brush your teeth, you wash your hands with soap, you wash your hair. So it's something that you do every day. So now we are teaching you how to choose correctly, you know. So it might be a little bit easier for us because we have a choice. We can use awareness to address this. Other organizations are trying to scare you, you know, and showing you really ugly pictures and scary videos of animal suffering. But we are teaching you to use a really good product that it will work for you. But and also, it's a amazing thing behind that, you know, with great ingredients, cruelty-free, for example, nice packaging, zero waste, etc. So I think that's our advantage because there's something that you do every day.
Yeah, we have this Facebook page where people comes in and says, "Hey, I have curly hair, it's dry, what can I use?" And we tell them, "You can use this," and everything that we tell them to use, it's cruelty-free. So sometimes you don't even know you're picking this kind of products. We don't care why you're picking them. So as Nicole said, we're teaching you how to choose better, but for many different reasons. Just because we have a necessity, or you want to learn how to get your makeup done, or you just want a better deodorant, or you want natural products. So we approach it in a different type of view. We never mentioned that someone got killed unless you ask us, and we'll tell you. And we are going to direct you to the organization that actually put the videos in if you want to see them. We don't even have them on our website. That's how.
But I love the fact that you said earlier, when you shop, you vote. And that was really like a conscious moment for me. And I'm going to be much more conscious that when I shop, I'm voting for a particular stance or position in terms of the environment. Monica.
Two questions, one for you and one for you. How is the process of certifying a company? You just trust them? If they say, yeah, we don't taste them anymore, you just trust them? Or how is that? All the process to certify them?
Well, at first what we did was ask other organizations how they did it. We didn't invent the process, so they were kindly enough to tell them how they did it. So we got the European process and the United States process. They were so different. In general terms, they were similar, but the European one is so hard that no Latin American company would have ever been able to accomplish it back then. So what we did is we took all of these two processes and we shake them up and we turned it into a national one. And that has two elements, basic elements. One, we need to know which ingredients the brand is using for all of their products. So we check, 274 is as much as I've checked. No, but you don't see it. I mean,
you assess the product itself.
Yeah, I mean the people, the company tells me, "Hey, I'm using this," and then the company tells in a sheet, Excel sheet, and then they tell me this is our catalog of products, and I've been researching so many products that I know what a shampoo contains, in general terms. So I know if they're lying, because I know if they have a shampoo, it must have one of two ingredients. If they're not there, I know it's not enough. So it's horrible in that way. Just as Ken said, if I'm dropping out of the certification, no one could certify because it's all in my brain, and that's a problem right now. Mm-hmm. So, well, I check all the ingredients, and then I ask them to tell me where are they buying the ingredients locally, and also where are those ingredients from. So I know they buy it in that store, and that store is importing that ingredient from Australia. So then I ask them to get a certification from the Australian company, the security sheet. And in the security sheet, there's a little sign. I don't know if anyone is a chemist or something, but there's a part when you have the toxicity assessment of the ingredient. And that part is the one that has whether it was tested or not. So the company is just an intermediate to the information that I really need So you cannot lie on the you cannot invent a proveedor?
Supplier.
I cannot invent a supplier. She cannot invent a supplier because I'm going to talk to that supplier. They are going to talk to. So we get 274 security sheets. I check it one by one. And if it has a problem, if it's tested on animals, they have two choices. Remove it. And that means taking some products out of the market, which companies have done it. And I'm very proud of that. Or change the supplier. That's the common. Of course, no one wants to take that product out of the market. So it's a 6 to 1 year process because cosmetic companies, and you know that, change all the time and change suppliers all the time. So we check that from one side. And the other side, we check where are they producing the products. If they're nationally, if they are important. If they have important things, we need declarations from the importer itself with their signature delivered to us by the brand. So basically the brand is just doing this all the time. I said no, and he goes back to their supplier and is like, please, please, please. I said no, and it's back and forth a year. And then at the end of the process, they signed a very strict contract that has is 4 pages long. It's ridiculous. I mean, that's our like core business in the certification. When we give the permission to use our logo based on the information being truthful, based on the information being complete, and that lasts 1 year. So, and the next year, I'm all the way. Can you show me the 274? I mean, you cannot imagine how many sheets of toxicology tests I review every single day of the year. And we do create the event. So sometimes they call me up, the brands, big ones, and they say, I have to print my packaging next week. Can I get the logo license? And I'm like, dude, go ahead and print them out because it's going to be a year since you get our logo license. So it's not as easy as some people get in their heads. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, it's true. I mean, when you look at B Corp, it's the same thing they're trying to do with corporations. Mm-hmm. And it's a far more complex model. Last question.
She said two. She said
no. So this is a quick answer because we want to do some quick fire questions.
Question. Is this the student, does he or she mentor just one entrepreneur, or one student mentors different entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so what we do is we work with 5 students, match them with one entrepreneur or one group of entrepreneurs in a cooperative. And then what will happen is the most talented students will be coaches for the new groups of students. So that's how we scale the model. To assure that we can work with more and more entrepreneurs every time, and at the same time inspire and train more students to obtain these skills.
Excellent.
Yeah.
To the two enterprises, you measure very well your outcomes, which is phenomenal, but how do you measure your impact? Because impact is...
This is the last question. Perfect question. How do you measure impact?
How do you measure impact? Because what you're creating is, in the end, systemic change to a particular issue. Mm-hmm. So your outcomes are phenomenal, but what mechanisms do you take to measure impact?
I'm going to leave this.
Yeah, well, because we raise awareness and we do a lot of social media and press media, our impacts are related to that, you know? Okay. How many mentions on press do we have? How many new followers do we have this year? How many new brands are now in Chile that are certified? You know, that's how we measure impact in our case.
Yeah, so for us it's very case specific, as I mentioned in the presentation as well, because for every enterprise that we work with, we will have different targets because every enterprise has different problems. So for all the enterprises, we will look at several metrics, but some metrics, for example, if we work on marketing and obtaining higher prices for one enterprise, those will be the prime metrics, whereas for others, cost cutting will be much more important. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite interesting that you mentioned impact, because that's something that's very, there's a lot of opportunity for that in the social enterprise world. Mm-hmm. For me, because I have a business and economics background, I know sort of the thinking that goes into designing this issue, but I think for a lot of the other social enterprises that I've talked with, we see a lot of basically every social entrepreneur has their thing, their skill set, as Nadia referred to it. For example, maybe helping animals, or maybe focusing on the environment. And what I see with talking with a lot of other social entrepreneurs is that they're very passionate about what they do, but the social impact part is where they want to learn more about, or where they need to learn more about. So that's something I think that has a lot of potential in the social entrepreneurship world, that there's a lot of investment in helping social entrepreneurs figure out which metrics to create to assess their impact. It's something really important.
And Eliana, is it just the benefit?
Yeah, for me, it's literally the benefit that goes directly to the farmers.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's clean, it's stupid. Yeah. You can have
easy to explain.
Okay, it's quick, like literally, because I do have some quick fire questions, which I want the class, what are they reading, who are they following on Instagram, which really helps the whole. Those are really important questions. Yeah.
That's because we just promote companies that are certified by us or other organizations, like PETA in the US or Living Bunny here in Europe. So that's the way we assure you that this is a cruelty-free product.
In terms of our reputation, we build it up by scratch. I mean, we were no one. It was good and bad at the same time, that there was no one talking about it. So we started building, I'm going to say trust fund, but not in the bad way. a trust fund, really, like in a concept. So what we did was assuring that we were telling the truth.
I like that, trust fund. A different version of a trust fund.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we were telling the truth, and we had all the information to tell you that you should trust us. And that's what we sell. We sell trust.
Yeah.
So we build a reputation based on us being genuine, having all the information, giving everything. I mean, our salaries are open. Everyone can know anything about us if you ask. So as long as people got to know that and got to know that about us, you spread the word and you say, no, these guys, like they're the real deal. So worth by word, and with the work that Nicole has been doing, is incredible. People know that they can trust us. So that's why when we got the haters for the campaign, it was so weird, because everyone loves us so much.
I love you.
Haters. Yeah.
Forget the haters, we love you.
So that's how we sell trust. That's what we did.
Okay, so thank you all. Let's give our panel a round. The last 5 minutes to 7 minutes, quick fire questions. Who do you follow on Twitter or Instagram? Because if you're like me and you don't think anybody's worthy of being followed on Twitter, or Instagram, no, who do you follow on Twitter or Instagram?
So I don't have Twitter.
Sorry.
There you go. I think I have it. It's still open. I just haven't tweeted anything in ages. I do have Instagram.
Yeah.
And I follow lots of artists. So Coco Capitan, who's been doing things for Gucci, is really good.
People should check out some of these.
I have a passion for horses. So lots of the things that I do are like horsey inspired. So I follow lots of breeders because I love horses. The big fashion brands and the big things that, you know, it's always good to draw inspiration, and I surprisingly don't follow Instagrammers, but there you go.
Yeah, I'm also not on Twitter. I'm very inactive on Instagram. So no answer from me.
Okay.
Follow anybody on Twitter. What about you guys?
I don't have Twitter either. I use Instagram.
This is proof that Twitter is dying.
But I do have Instagram.
And who do you follow?
And it's funny because they wrote us the fire questions before.
Yeah.
And I told Nicole, like, who do I follow? And I'm going to be real honest with you. I just follow empowered women. I follow women that have huge businesses in pop culture. that's who I follow. I follow Kim Kardashian. I follow Beyonce. I follow all of the girls. They have this powering message, and they have these huge businesses that no one can understand why. So Nicole was like, Amila, you have to follow someone. I mean, come on. Just pop. And I'm like, no, I have to. So I found that I follow someone that's in the zero waste business. She's a designer. She's amazing. She's called Leila Aka Glupul or something. And I love her because she's a designer. I studied design too. I'm a designer. I hate it, but she's amazing. So she designs products that are going to that doesn't have this program failure thingy that now design have. So she's zero waste and she's amazing. But I also follow all of the women that have amazing business in pop culture. That's what and. Kitties, everything with cats on it. I'm like this old cat.
So your cats are my horses.
Yeah, yes. So, I'm a cat person.
Cats and horses.
Well, actually, it's funny because we work like this in our office with Nicole, and every time I see a cute picture of a cat, I'm like, Nicole, just see it. And Nicole's like, wait, I'm working. Like, no, please. Yeah, so it's funny. Poor girls.
The one book. She has.
I am individual.
Yeah. We're both individuals.
I follow a lot of musicians and a lot of NGOs and a lot of feminist groups also.
Which is give them one or two names.
Yeah, this is a Chilean one, really important, called Observatorio del Acoso Callejero, and they are putting a bill so people can arrest women on the street. That's really important in Chile, so I recommend that.
For sure.
One book or one article, it does not have to be a book that everyone as a social entrepreneur in this room should read. Book or article, it does not have to be a book. Because we don't want to shame anybody who doesn't read books.
I do read books. I just don't read entrepreneurial books. I read lots of literature, but yeah. But with regard to this, I think like every morning I read Business of Fashion because I need to know what's on, what's trend, and it's surprisingly been speaking a lot about Vicuña lately, so I'm like, yes, good. Raising awareness. And then...
Sorry. You like podcasts?
Okay, I'll do podcasts next. You're the boss.
So I read Business of Fashion and I try to read the Deloitte and the PwC reports regarding to luxury markets.
This is very good.
Because that's I need to advice. Know the size of my market when I need to when I'm telling people like this is why everyone's going to buy my £2,000 scarf. It's because there is a market for it. It's £2 billion market. Yeah. £12 billion market actually.
Yeah, for me, my biggest recommendation would be as well to become an expert on what you do on your topic and read as much about that as you can because that's what's going to distinguish you from
so what's the other.
Well, I think it's very specific to the project that you're doing. And in general, my one book that I would advise you doing is now reading Starting With Why. That's why I mentioned Remembering the Why.
I saw him last year.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Simon,
so I think that's putting a lot of the experiences that I had in perspective. So I would recommend you to read that.
Yeah, so now it's funny again because I recommend everyone to read. If you don't read, I mean, really, you have to. I once dated a guy, he said, I didn't read, and I'm like, okay, bye. Like, come on. So that's the first thing. I read a lot, but I read a lot of books. They have a historic context, so I can learn. But these are drama novels and series, so I really liked this mixture of
literature.
Literature.
Who has time to read literature?
But I don't.
Who enjoy it?
I love it.
Make time.
I don't have this. I don't read these inspirational books. You know about this special author that it's so cool. I just really like to learn about the history because I think the past. You have to have it very clear. So not right now. I'm reading a book in Spanish that it's about Birmania a couple of years ago where they have these big politic problems and these 13 tourist guys disappear in this amazing country in Asia. So that's what I'm reading right now. It's called The City of Nothing.
The City of Nothing.
Yeah, well, I read a lot of different things, inspiration things and everything, but I want to recommend you a documentary about Sebastián Salgado. I don't know if anyone here knows them. It's called La Sal de la Tierra. It's on Netflix, and it's amazing. It can change your life, because this guy was an economic guy, and at the age of 13, he says, hey, I don't want to do economics. I want to do something else. I want to take pictures of the world in Africa, of people, get everyone to know what's going on in South America, in Africa, raise awareness. And he changed his life at 30 years old, so that's definitely something that I would recommend.
What's the name of the...
The salt of the earth?
La sal de la tierra? La sal de la tierra. The salt of the earth?
Oh, okay.
Yes. Okay, awesome. And this is the last question that I'll combine. Podcast. What podcast would you recommend?
So I still...
And if not podcast. But in addition, just in case some of you don't look at podcasts, who influenced you most in this field, right? Who do you... really like admire, and you think the students would be good for them to have a look at, you know, in terms of really moving in this space. So what podcast do you follow? And if you don't follow podcasts, don't say anything, we know what that means. But really, who influenced you the most? Who are the people who really like blew your mind in this field and made you really think, yeah, social entrepreneurship?
Okay, so with regards to podcasts, I think I'm still old school and I listen to Freakonomics. Like, I know it's like very old. It's very, like, it's a classical thing to say, but it's really good. And when it comes to social entrepreneurship, I think that my approach to it, it's not, the people that I've met are not widely recognized, but I, for some reason, have been in touch with people who have worked with communities in Peru and have done work one-on-one. So I've gotten lots and lots from them, but they're not public figures. They just do their work and, like, do and go home. But I also, I told you I work for Techo, here in the fundraising efforts and in Colombia in the charitable work. And then I volunteer here for Mary's Giving and Living, which is a charity shop that basically receives donation and sells it to people. Like, I mean, they get really amazing things from designers and from like high-end things, and the profits go to Save the Children, and I help them with window display and merchandising. So I think that talking to my reporters, who is the person who's behind it, was like, well, you really do have an idea of how to bridge these two worlds together. And that would be the one person.
What's the name again?
Mari Portas. She was like this, she was the one that, she's a big fashion name in the UK, and she did the Harvey Nicks store in like the 90s. She was the one behind it and now runs a consultancy firm.
Okay.
Oh, and also in fashion, eco-fashion, Livia Firth, who I was telling you about. Also, she's now the person behind EcoAge, who's a fashion consultancy firm that helps fashion brands go green.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. So for podcasts, I am really interested in also the more behavioral economics. It's always really fun to listen to. I'm now a bit addicted to listening to a lot of psychology podcasts. It's really interesting to hear how people think about other people, and I really like to do that in my...
So which one? Do you have one that you recommend?
I'm not listening to one from the BBC, I'm not sure the name, okay. But they have a lot of interesting podcasts about psychology. So that's what I like to do, and then what inspires me most, or who inspires me most, I think for me the best motivator has been, or the best inspiration has been, the people that I talk to on the project. So I mentioned before, listen to other social entrepreneurs, but I also want to focus, or want to mention, listen to the people, your beneficiaries, listen to the people that you do your work for. And I think that's the biggest and most important inspiration to have.
Awesome.
I don't even know what podcast is. I mean, I was like, what is it?
Yeah, so
I don't know if I'm from another, I mean, I'm from another world, South America. I have no idea what that is. So I cannot answer that question. But in terms of the people that inspire me the most, is like I told you before, I really have meaningful relationships with my clients, with our clients. We have so many inspiring women that own cosmetic companies, you cannot believe. I mean, they're not famous, Lanita, Luz. I mean, there's just filled
with conscience and filled with trying to get their brands that have amazing products and they don't know how to put them out there. So I've been in touch with three especially that I remember. Two of them told me the mantra out of nowhere. I mean, 2 or 3 hours talking. I had a business meeting. I end up going home at 11 p.m. Because they are, these people, they're starting, and I'm going to refer just to three. They're not famous, but maybe you know their brands, and if you see them in South America, I want you to buy them. So the first one is called Apicola del Alba. The owner, her name is Luz. It's light in Spanish. Well, you probably all know. So she has a business. She has her family owns a lot of lands in a special part of the mountains in Santiago. And she has bees colonies. And she has organic, farming. Yeah, organic farming with bees. So she sells bee honey, and she has cosmetic creams, hair products, without using sulfates, without using chemicals, with only bees from organic. She lets the bees rest in winter. I mean, it's amazing. It's ridiculous how amazing you can grow. I'm going to say grow is not the word, but
develop.
It's just make the bees be good while giving you honey. Because you can do a lot of horrible things like giving antibiotics and kill them in the winter and a lot of things. So she takes care of the bees like they're her sons, and she takes care of the woods like you wouldn't believe. So it's such an inspiration for me to meet people like that. And she doesn't tell anyone. She lives in the woods. She cares to take care of her bees, and she has a successful business, and she makes tons of money, and she only hires women. And she keeps like a year of maternal leave. It's ridiculous. I mean, the way this woman is running her business, it gives me hope in the world. So this is the first. Apicola del Alba, it's called. It's just in Chile right now, but for sure she's going to be all over the place. The second one is called Surya Brazil. It's a little bit more, it's bigger. There are in 40 countries, so it's a bigger company. The owner, she's 60, 65. She started 40 years ago when no one was talking about it. And what she does is she works with local communities in the rainforest from Brazil to take out ingredients that are native from the places in a sustainable way. And she produces it. We went to the factory in Sao Paulo, and they gave breakfast to the people from the from the neighborhood every Monday. They are all vegan. I mean, everyone is so happy in that company. It's ridiculous. And she takes care of every ingredient she puts on the market. And then she exports to 40 countries. So it's like, I love seeing that. I mean, people taking care of the business so much and taking care of every single detail and paying fair to the person that working there. And they have a successful business. She's making money. And in her house, she has like horses and pigs, and she has like 50 types of... So she runs out in the middle of the day so she can feed the animals. And it's, oh my God, that woman, Clelia, it's called. It's amazing. And the third one is actually a European company. It's called Sao Makeup. Maybe you've seen it. It's 50 countries. It's a small organic cosmetic company. The owner, he's amazing. I mean, his dad is disabled. We were in a 3-hour meeting, just talking. We just say goodbye and left because he's from Europe and there's not much communication. But so he has this organic product, makeup. Like finding organic makeup, it's impossible. And then he has the factory in a place
in France,
but the packaging, he does it someplace else, so he works locally with ingredients in the factory in France, and then someplace else in Italy, he produces the packaging. So he was trying to develop a natural and sustainable packaging, and when he didn't found it, he invented it. So he started creating this packaging, who's reusable. So the powder is over, then you take it out and you put it in the same packaging with bamboo, which is crafted from China with local people. I mean, you cannot believe how behind he's worried about it. And then because his dad is disabled, he works only with disabled people in the factory. Incredible. And they maintain these prices all over the world. It's a little bit expensive because it is organic makeup. So meeting that people, that kind of people, in our background, it's like you could not, and that's just three. We have 55 certified companies. I mean, you could have so much stories, just like you, happens to you, with people that are amazing, and they're doing good business. And that's most inspiring for me, because people think that if you do good, you're going to be like poor or living in the woods or whatever. And it's like, no, you can have successful business
and live in the woods also.
And be so happy. I mean, that house, my God, it's amazing. So that's the people that are inspiring me.
I will support that because... Yeah.
So, no, that's it.
You're backing me up.
Backing you up. Yeah.
Thank you so much. On behalf of LSE, you're welcome to LSE without having a little bit of, memorabilia for the two people. But on behalf of LSE, the students in my master's program, as well as the wider LSE community, we just really want to... They left the prize off.
No one saw anything.
Okay, thank you.
We just really wanted to thank you. We just really wanted to thank you guys for your time, for flying in. Several of these people flew in from halfway across the world, 15 hours from Chile.
Yeah.
3 hours?
Yeah, 4 hours.
Four hours, plenty of time.
30 minutes.
Just an Uber ride.
And of course, Ken, that's why he had to go back to Cambridge right now. So we just really want to appreciate and thank you guys. You all are now part of the SIE tribe and community, and we look forward to continually chatting with you all, see your journey, interacting with the rest of the class. And, you know, I can't thank you guys enough for this experience. And I think we have to give you guys a stand up.